Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Okay. Now, here's the problem. It's been the problem since we started the book of Daniel, and that's what in the world these different, what does the image mean, who the metals refer to, who the beasts refer to, and then chapter 8 again, who are the two beasts there. Now, in chapter 8, it specifically says, doesn't it, 20, 21, who the beasts are. The ram is the kingdom of Medo-Persia, and the he-goat, or the shaggy goat, is the kingdom of Greece. So, this last column, we know for sure that that ram is Persia and the goat is Greece. Now, you can almost tell my theology by where I've placed those two in relation to the other ones. I have pretty well consistently at least tried to convince you that the way I think this kingdom should run is, number one, in chapter 2, we know for sure at least one kingdom in chapter 2. What kingdom is that? Okay. Asia Minor? Well, in chapter 2, that head of gold is said to be Nebuchadnezzar, right? So we know that gold is Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the rest of them aren't identified until you get over there to chapter 8 and the ram and the goat are identified. Now, the way it seems like to me, following secular history about the empires of that area, it should be Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Okay. And then we come to chapter 7. I think chapter 7 is an amplification of chapter 2. Well, if chapter 7 is an amplification of chapter 2, the king is the same. The lion will be Babylon, the bear will be Medo-Persia, the leopard will be Greece, and the beast, unidentified or undefined, will be Rome. Now, if that's true, now this is presupposition because the Bible doesn't say exactly what those kingdoms are. If that's true, then that ram and he-goat of chapter 8 fit right there. You say, well, why did I go all this trouble to show me these different things? Remember in chapter 7, a little thing called the little horn, remember that? It blasphemed against God and tore up three other horns and all. It appears in this last one. It appears in this undefined beast, Rome. But in chapter 8, there's another little horn. And guess where it appears? It appears in Greece. Now, the problem with interpretation has always been is the little horn of 8 and the little horn of 7 to be identified with each other. Now, if you belong to a particular dispensational school, or if you belong to the two people who want to argue about this are dispensationalists who believe that both little horns refer to the Antichrist, or people who believe that, well, they just have a real problem with predictive prophecy, and therefore they would say that the little horns identify with each other simply because they can't believe that Daniel could have known the future. Now, there's two different groups, the far right wing and the far left wing. Both don't like the scheme I just gave you. But I think it fits better everything. And then we'll get into it. We get into chapter 8. Now, I want you to know the setting of chapter 8. It's in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. Okay, now, where does that make chapter 8? When, chronologically, did chapter 8 come in relationship to chapter 7? Remember? The opening words of chapter 7 say, in the first year of the reign of Belshazzar. So 2 years later, this vision came. Now remember that chapter 7 and chapter 8 and possibly some other ones come chronologically before chapter 5, don't they? Now that's confusing. What I'm saying is the book's not in a chronological order. Chapter 5 is Belshazzar's feast, okay? So the two visions in the reign of Belshazzar got to come before chapter 6, okay? So this is not chronological, all right? And that's kind of hard to get in our mind, but it's not that way. Now, you see there in verse 2 where it says he has a vision, okay? And he looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking. It means he was in the vision. Now, chapter 7 seems to imply that he might have been asleep. He lay on his bed. Now, he probably was asleep when the dream came, vision came. Chapter 8, he's not in the bed anywhere. He's in Susa, the capital of Persia. Now, question arises, is he there physically? Is he there in this vision? I think he's there in the vision. I don't think he's there physically. I'll tell you why. Shishak, which is the other name for this town, or Susa, is the capital of the Persian Empire. And Daniel is the third ruler of the Babylonian Empire. It just wasn't real healthy for him to be in Susa. Number two, Susa is not a real capital now. It's a city. It's a large city, but it's not the capital of anything. I think he's there in the spirit more than anything, and I think he sees this kingdom of Persia at its greatest height as he's in the capital. He's in the citadel, or in the castle part of that capital city. So I think it's a vision, just like the vision that John had on the Isle of Patmos, just like the vision that Paul had in 2 Corinthians, and on and on. I think it's a vision, okay? Now, he was in Susa, that's the capital of Persia, and he was by a canal, and the canal is called Ulai, or something like that, because I can't pronounce Aramaic rivers any better than you can. he is by this river. This is some river. It's really a canal. Your translation might have the so-and-so Ulai Canal, does it? Does anybody have that? Verse 2, chapter 8? What translation is that? New American Standard. We've found this canal archaeologically, and it's 900 feet wide. It's a big canal. Big canal. It links two rivers close to the capital of Persia for trade purposes. And apparently that's where Daniel was taken in the spirit to have this vision. Now, notice, if you will, down in verse 4. I think the best thing for us to do, since it's a short chapter, is go ahead and let me read, because I think reading the Bible is extremely important. Let me read verses 3 and 4, and then we'll comment by paragraph. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns and was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and with the longer one coming up last. And I saw a ram budding westward and northward and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. Okay, remember back in chapter 7, we talked about the bear, and the bear equals the ram. And the bear was raised on one side as if walking, and the bear had three ribs in his mouth. He said, wow, kind of stuff. Well, I think the idea of the bear walking is again the symbol of the Medo-Persian Empire. Persia was the dominant one, or the aggressive one. The Media part was not. So it's representing these two kind of horns, one longer than the other, coming up last, is the kingdom of Cyrus. That is part of this Medo-Persian Empire, okay? And now the three ribs we talked about in the bear's mouth, I think it's very good to identify that with these three different directions of the compass. The west, the north, and the south. Now, there's countries represented there. The south is what would be what country? What major country to the south? Egypt. And therefore, to the north would be what? Lystra? It's that northern kind of way. Now listen, why would it just have three parts of the compass and not four? Well, it's very interesting. We find from the records that we have that there was absolutely no military campaigns to the east until the reign of Darius. They didn't go that way. Ain't that unusual? But this is exactly what it talks about. They went to the west, the north, and the south. No mentions of the east. And from archaeological discoveries, we find that that's absolutely historically accurate. But this kingdom of Medo-Persia did not have aggression to the east until much later in the period of history. Now, by the way, that little reference is in 7:5. That'll help you some, okay? I want to talk about the ram, and I want to talk about the he-goat, but I think I'm going to wait until we get to verses 20 and 21, which defines who these empires are, and maybe we can understand why these two symbols are identified. You realize that when it says that no other beast could stand before it, that this is saying that the other countries were seen as beasts. Now, you say, that's ridiculous. Have you ever thought the nations of the world all have an animal as a symbol? The United States has the eagle, does it not? Who has the bear? Who has the lion? England. Every nation has a beast as an emblem. And so it's kind of following that the Bible calls these nations beasts because of the way they act toward one another. Now, in 5 through 8, please. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came up to the ram that had two horns, which had been standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in a mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. Now, this thing enraged, and this thing mad. Let me stop just for a second. You realize that, let me think of that king that did it. I think it was Darius III that kept attacking the nation of Greece. It kept crossing that little part of water and kept attacking Greece all the time. It made Greece so mad that when Alexander came to power, Alexander took 30,000 men and 5,000 cavalry, I think, and he came across that little canal himself, and he met that Persian king that had 600,000 troops. So you got 35,000 against 600,000. But the Grecian army was so well trained, so organized, and so mobile that they beat those 6,000 men. Finally, when the commander or the king of Persia found out they could not stop Alexander the Great, he sent a letter and said, "Let's divide the land up. You take part, I'll take part." Alexander wrote back and said, "I am so mad at you, I will not share anything to you. I'm going to kill you, or you're going to kill me." You see, the Greeks got mad because they kept attacking, trying to put them under subjugation. And so when they got a chance, they just put their foot on the neck of Persia. And that's what it said, the idea of wrath here, enraged. So I think it's very good. Now, "And he struck the ram and shattered the two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him." The guy's upset. "And there was none to rescue the ram from his power. And the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, a large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of the earth." Wow, you see, this stuff's too deep for me, too wild, huh? Not that wild as you think. Let's go back and think of the symbolism in the other chapters and kind of take a little chunk at a time. I think we can get it. Number one, what does the idea of a horn always stand for? A king, right? Or it could be power. Have you ever seen, I think it's Rembrandt or one of those guys, picture of Moses, a real famous painting, and Moses has two horns? You ever seen that? Just like a Grecian god kind of pan instead of in Moses. But they got that from misinterpretation of one of the Old Testament passages. A horn also stands for power, okay? So it stands for king, it stands for power. So when we talk about this thing having two horns, talking about two powerful kings or two powerful kingdoms, Medo-Persia, and then the horns are broken by a large horn out of the front of this male goat, okay? The thing I could keep thinking about is a unicorn. The horn came between his eyes, the big horn. Now that big horn symbolizes a king. And if that kingdom, as we're going to find in verse 21, is Greece, what is that big horn? Got to be Alexander III or Alexander the Great, okay? You can put that right next to your Bible. That big horn is Alexander the Great. Now, he breaks the other two horns. That means the symbol of Persian power is broken, gone. Now, when it says in verse 5 that he came from the west, does that fit with the symbolism of Greece? Sure it does. Sure it does. Now, when it says that he came as hovering over the ground, you know, just not touching the ground, does that fit with the symbolism of chapter 7, identifying the leopard with four wings? Speed, remember? Yes, it does. Alexander conquered countries faster than you can imagine. Friends, he just took over the world before, and he died at 32 or 33. He was a very fast kind of conqueror, okay? Now, let's see. Okay, down in verse 8, where it says, magnified himself, when the he-goat, male goat, magnified himself exceedingly. Now, this is a kind of a way that the translators have of taking a Greek verb or Greek tense and trying to explain it. But they've really missed it just a little bit here. The English translation, magnifies himself exceedingly, seems to be an egocentric motive, doesn't it? Seems like that he was bragging, like the little horn, right? I'm great and I'm getting greater. This is not an egocentric kind of phrase. It doesn't mean that Alexander was boasting of how good he was. A better translation would be, he became successful, or he became great, or he was growing. It's not the fact that he was bragging about it. It was a historical fact. He's getting bigger. He becomes the ruler of the known world, you know. So it's not an ego thing. It's just a historical fact that he was becoming a very great leader. Now, notice it says in verse 8, the big horn was broken, and Alexander died. Now, I always heard that Alexander died of syphilis. And yet the commentaries and the histories I've been reading says he died of marsh fever. I don't know how to relate those two. I'm not really sure what he died of, but he died in Babylon, and he died at the age 32 or 33. So the big horn is broken. Now, look what it says. And four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of the earth took over. Now, who? Have we talked about that before? Have we? How about the four heads of chapter 7? Remember we talked about heads could represent kings because of the head of gold in chapter 2? So it's these Greek generals that divided up Alexander's kingdom. And here they are again, just in case you need them. Ptolemy took Egypt. Philip took Macedonia. Seleucus took Syria and Babylonia. And Lysimachus took Thrace. So we have these. It just fits perfectly historically. That's why people who are extremely liberal want to say, oh, this is written much later. This is a historical chapter. You see, if you don't believe in predictive prophecy, it bothers you because it's so detailed and so minute. Now, notice, let me read verse 9 through 14. Better yet, you read verse 9 through 13 in your translation, please. 9 through 13. 14. 9 through 14. Out of one of the other horns, doesn't he? Right? And now, the one in chapter 7 tears out three horns, right? And he takes their place. Here, this one grows out of one of the four horns. Now, the symbolism here is too much for me to believe that this is anybody but Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, he is the one who's going to do some historical thing. Ooh, by the way, Winston, would you go in my office and get a book called The Apocrypha on my desk? I want to read part of First Maccabees if I could. It's on my desk, orange book. We learn about Antiochus Epiphanes from the book of 1 Maccabees, which is in the Catholic Bible. It's in this Bible, too. I don't know if you have a big family Bible at home. See, it says, with Apocrypha. Yours may have this, your family Bible. And 1 Maccabees is a very good historical book. We don't have it in the canon. It's in the Catholic canon. It's in the Episcopal canon, but we just don't have it. And I want to read part of you about this man, Antiochus Epiphanes. But that's who I think it is. And notice the little word, the beautiful land, in verse 9. You may have the glorious land or the beautiful or the ornamental. What do you have in King James? What? Pleasant land. Well, this is referring to Palestine, and it's the land flowing with milk and honey, what they're talking about. And the reason that this little king, he's not that he's just a big king, but he attacks the very people of God. He does some things to the temple of God that you're not going to believe what he did. And so, therefore, because this book is oriented around God's people, this book becomes... this king becomes exceedingly important, you see. Now, notice, if you will, the idea about, and it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them. Now, that's just symbolic as it can be, isn't it? First of all, who are the stars? As you just read this, who do the stars seem to be? Well, at first thing, you might want to say angels, wouldn't you? But looking a little further, you find in biblical symbolism that stars often refer to the people of God. I think I have it in your thing there, Genesis 15:5, Daniel 12:3. Some people even give Matthew 13:4, but I don't think that fits real well, so I didn't list it for you. Now, if these are God's people, and this king is going to grow up and knock some down, have any of y'all been reading the book of the Revelation for Sunday night? You got to chapter 12 yet? Chapter 12, verse 4, which speaks of the woman is giving childbirth and the dragon is chasing her, trying to kill the child and all. It almost seems that beautiful symbolism there of the birth of Christ and his fight with the satanic forces almost comes from this book of Daniel about the stars of heaven and that kind of thing. Very possible. Now, notice what's going to happen. This king, in verse 11, he magnified himself to be equal with the commander of the host. Now, when you sing that great hymn by Martin Luther, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, and on, when it says, Lord Sabaoth, his name from age to age the same, and he will win the battle. Do you know what Lord Sabaoth means? Sabaoth is just a transliteration of a Greek word that means host, and therefore it really means that God is the commander of the armies of heaven. He's the same little kind of title here. The commander of the army of heaven refers to the Lord of hosts in your English Old Testament. Now, so he's even coming to argue with God or put himself against God. Notice what he's going to do. And it, now the it there is because of the grammar, it's him, it's Antiochus Epiphanes, removed the regular sacrifices from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. Now this is very important. The regular sacrifices, turn just over to verse 12 if you would, and you see there the regular sacrifices again mentioned in verse 12. Now this, the regular sacrifice is an interpretive English translation of a Hebrew word that simply says, and simply means, the continually. Now, what the continually means, the English translators here have said, it means the regular sacrifice. Like, for instance, they sacrifice the lamb every morning, right? They sacrifice the lamb every evening. It's called the morning and the evening sacrifice. They also regularly did the little bit with the incense, right? In the Holy of Holies, took that incense in, threw it on the altar, it made smoke. And they had regular things they did. Now, I think instead of being just the morning and evening sacrifice, that what we have here, that he stopped every kind of regular service in the temple, this guy stopped. Notice when it says he, in his sanctuary was thrown down. Now, but when this verb is used in Hebrew, and we're in Hebrew again, not we're out of Aramaic now, chapter 8 begins the Hebrew section, this word always has a very bad connotation. So a better English translation would be the word defiled. He defiled the sanctuary of God. Now, I want to read you a little bit about Antiochus Epiphanes, if I could. Let me see here. Okay. I need to know where to start. Now, this guy, and later on, about verse 23, it's going to say how crafty this man is. I'm going to read to you how he captured Jerusalem. This is 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 29. After 2 years, the king sent an officer to collect tribute from the towns of Judah, and he entered Jerusalem with a strong force, and he spoke to them craftily in peaceful terms, and they trusted him. Then suddenly fell upon the city and struck it a great blow and destroyed many of the people of Israel. He plundered the city. He burned it down. He tore down the houses in it, the walls around it. He took the women and children captive and possessed themselves of the cattle. They fortified the city of David with great strong walls and with strong towers, and it became their citadel. And they put sinful heathens there who did not obey the law, and they entrenched themselves there. And they stored up weapons and provisions, and they collected the spoils of Jerusalem and laid them up there. And they became a great threat, and it proved a place of ambush against the sanctuary and the wicked adversary to Israel constantly. And they shed innocent blood all around the sanctuary, and they polluted the sanctuary itself. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem fled away from them. And she became a place where strangers lived. And she became strange to her own offspring, and her children forsook her. And her sanctuary became a desolate, like a wilderness. Her feasts were turned into grief. Her Sabbath became a reproach. Her honor became contempt. Her dishonor was as great as her glory had been, and her exaltation was turned into grief. Now, a little bit further. And the king sent word to the messengers to Jerusalem and to the towns of Judah to practice the following, foreign to the people there. They put a stop to the burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings at the sanctuary, to break the Sabbath, to profane the feast, to pollute the sanctuary, to build altars and sacred precincts to idols and build temples, to sacrifice hogs, and you know how bad it was to a Jew, to sacrifice hogs and unclean cattle, to leave their sons uncircumcised, and to defile themselves with every unclean and profane practice, so that they might forget the law and change their religious ordinances, and anyone who did not obey the command of the king should die. And then finally, and they found the sanctuary desolate, and the altar polluted, and the doors burned, and the weeds growing in the courts as they do in the wood or in some mountain. And the priest's quarters were torn down, and they tore their clothes and uttered great lamentations and covered themselves with ashes and fell on their face to the ground. Boy, I tell you what, the temple was polluted. This guy went in the temple of God, tricked them, got in the city of Israel, I mean the city of Jerusalem, told them one thing. When he got inside, he killed a bunch of them, took over the city. This king took a pig, took it on the altar of God and sacrificed it there, put up an altar to Zeus inside the temple, and stopped every kind of Jewish regulation. No more circumcision, no more food laws, no more feast days. That's why he's such a hideous kind of person to the Jews, as you can imagine. Now, back to verse 12. On account of the transgression. Now, I want you to keep your finger on that word transgression. What transgression are we talking about? Whose transgression? The transgression of the host. Now, who is the host? It's the people of God, isn't it? Now, just the previous verse or two, the host was the idea of God's people or God's army. Now, here the same word used, and the transgression is going to be the people of God's sin, not the Syrian sin. Now listen, And they took up regular sacrifices, and they will fling the truth to the ground and perform it. Its will, and he will prosper. Look in verse 13. Then I heard a holy one. Now, what holy one are we talking about? This is the regular word that's translated in the Old Testament, saint. It's always translated saint, except here. Now, who are we talking about? The holy one. An angel. Exactly, it's an angel. Have you ever heard an angel called a saint before? Well, if you turn the back of your book, and I want to give you four titles of angels that are very unusual, and I'll give you the scriptures where you can find them. Number one is the idea of angels as being saints, and that's very unusual to me, an angel called a saint. You've got the one in Daniel here, Daniel 8:13. You've got Psalms 89, 5, and 7. Zechariah 14:5. Saints, holy ones, title for angels. Also, angels are called the sons of God, aren't they? Where? Remember one reference? Book of Job. Job 1:6. Job 2:1. Remember, the sons of God came before the Lord, and with them came Satan. Psalm 29:1. Psalm 89:6, I believe. Can't read my own writing. Finally, they're called spirits. Hebrews 1:14. And they're also called watchers. Where are they called watchers? One chapter in all the Bible they're called watchers. If you don't get this, I'm going to cry. Where are they called watchers? Daniel 4. Just a little while over a month ago, we were there. Daniel 4, 13, 17, and 24. The only place in the Bible you have the word watchers. Okay. Just want to say, angels are called some very strange things. Now, a little bit later, he's going to ask how they look, and that's interesting. Now, in verse 14, it says, and he said, he got two angels talking about how long it's going to last and all this, and Daniel's listening. And then 14, and he said to them, said to me, for 2,300 evening and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. What in the world is 2,300 mornings and evenings, or evenings and mornings? Huh? Okay, 7 years. Now, that's one interpretation, Coy. If you take the 2,300 is days, like if morning or evening and morning refers like Genesis 1:5, and it was the evening and it was the morning and it was the first day. So if 2,300 refers to one full day, you've got 7 years. The other group says that evening and morning refers to that regular sacrifice I was talking to you about just two verses earlier. If it refers to the regular sacrifice, then they say it should be split in half, and what you've got is half of 2,300, which is what? 1,150. Works at a bank now. Well, oh, he has a book too. Tell you what. Well, anyway, so you've got two different views. Now, who do you think would want to have this around the number 1150? What would be important there? Why would 3.5 years? Why would one group of interpreters want this to be 3.5 years? Come on now, think with me. Exactly. Now, if you believe the little horns are the same, right, you want to link up chapter 7 and chapter 8. So when it says 2,300 evenings and mornings, and you believe that when it says a time and a half, and you believe that's 3.5 years, you're going to make that 23 evening and mornings, 3.5 years too. Now, if you don't think that 7 and 8 link up, you're probably going to say, oh, no, I go back to Genesis 1:5. This means it's 7 years, the number of completion. Now, it's not quite 7 years. It's a little less than 7 years. I think it's 6 years and 110 days, something like that. So it's close to 7 years, but not quite. Now, these biblical numbers are just kind of rounded off. If you start saying, I'm going to find exactly what happens, people have been reading this little book of Maccabees, trying to find out how they could fit 3.5 years in, how they can fit 7 years in. And of course, some say from the time that Antiochus Epiphanes took over and desecrated the temple until the rededication of the temple, which is called the Feast of Lights, or Purim for the Jews today, was 3 years. And that's close enough to make it 3.5, and you got it solved right there. Well, you still got a half a year hanging, so it's not solved to me. I don't know what it means. I probably would take it to be 7 years. My proof text would be Genesis 1:5, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Okay. Now, you see where it says the holy place will be properly restored? Now, what does that mean? Well, that's just a simple allusion to the fact that that temple was desecrated so badly that when the Maccabees, Judas the Hammer, finally beat the Syrians, they rededicated that temple. I think it was on December 12, 168 B.C. By the way, you know the Hanukkah time the Jews celebrate, we celebrate Christmas? What they're celebrating is the rededication of the temple by Judas Maccabeus in 168 B.C. It happened in December. That's what they're celebrating. We're celebrating Christmas. So notice again, look at verse 15, please, down through the end of the chapter. Why don't you just read it in your own translation? I can't give you long because we only got 11 minutes left. So read it as quickly as you can. 15 through 27. Okay, I hope you got most of the way down. Notice in verse 15, it talks about somebody like who looked like a man in the last of verse 15. We assume it's an angel, right? Because his name is going to be Gabriel. Why do you think it says, and he looked like a man? Well, here's the real biggie question. It's kind of a Greek question. It's not a Hebrew question, but I'll ask anyway. What does an angel look like? What does an angel look like? Are they feminine looking with big white robes and wings and bare feet? Little beards maybe? And the cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, let's think about that for a minute. Angels appear as men sometimes, don't they? Remember Abraham, three angels came. One was even identified with God almost. I mean, it was just the things he said were just like deity. So many of us think it was a pre-incarnate Christ that stayed with Abraham and watched the battle. But many times angels appear as men. But that doesn't mean they look like men all the time. It simply means they appear as men, doesn't it? They can appear as men, I put it that way. Everybody thinks angels have wings. That's necessarily true. The only people that have wings that we know of is the cherubim. They're the ones that kept the sword going both ways, that kept Adam and Eve from the tree of life after they'd sinned. And they're described in Exodus because they're put on top of the ark. They had four wings, right? They had four faces, the face of an ox, the face of a man, the face of a bear, and the face of an eagle, I believe. And then we have the seraphim in Ezekiel. They had six wings. They had some kind of feet because they were covering them. They had some kind of hands because they took it the coals of the altar with a tong to touch Isaiah's mouth. But what else they had, we don't know. Now, friends, that doesn't sound like a man, any of them. I never saw a man with six wings. Saw some guys flying, but never saw a guy with six wings. So I think that angels can take human form, but I'm not sure when an angel sleeps, he looks like a man. You know, I don't know what an angel looks like, really. And you don't either, really. Think about it. You say, well, it describes them this way, but they describe them a whole bunch of ways. Okay? So really, we don't know exactly what an angel looks like. Okay. And that's always causes a problem because we always want to have wings too. Maybe you will. Gabriel. Where have you heard that name before? Gabriel. Right? And where in the New Testament, Don? You remember? Luke chapter 1. He's the angel that comes to Elizabeth and he's the angel that comes to Mary. Daniel is the only book in all the Old Testament that names angels. It names two of them, doesn't it? Gabriel and later on Michael. Only the New Testament we hear the words Gabriel and Michael. Gabriel comes in Luke and Michael comes in Jude 6 and Revelation, I think, 12. Now, Gabriel seems to be a very high angel, and he always comes to interpret God's message to men. He is always an interpreting kind of person. Now, Michael is always the guardian angel of Israel. You know, he is a strong, fighting kind of angel. But Gabriel is an interpreter. Now, notice it says in verse 17, this angel comes over there, and Daniel's getting nervous again. Dad, I like these angels getting too close to him. And this angel came back up, and Daniel just went, fell back down the ground. He just lost all his strength, just plop, fell out. And the angel comes and touched him and says, get up, stupid. No, what does he say? Get up what? Son of man. Where have you heard that before? You've heard it twice. You've heard it two places, some in the Old Testament. One you've heard just last week, wasn't it? The Ancient of Days was sitting on his throne, and one likened to a son of man came to him, right? Daniel 7. But you've heard it somewhere else, too. Son of man, stand on your feet, and I will talk with you. The book of Ezekiel. Over and over and over and over and over again in the book of Ezekiel. He's called son of man. Also in the book of Zechariah a couple of times. Son of man. Now, this is a reference not to Daniel 7 again. Daniel 7 is this human kind of person that comes to the Ancient of Days to take the kingdom. He's not saying, Daniel, get up because I'm going to give you the kingdom. He's saying, Daniel, please get up so I can talk to you. You're scared to death, friend. But in Ezekiel, the word son of man simply means frail, weak humanity. That's what this angel's saying to Daniel. Get up, human. Get up, man. So, the reference to son of man here is not chapter 7. It's Ezekiel or Zechariah. Now, notice it says that these provisions pertain to the time of the end. Now, this has been the big fight. When does this relate to? When is this going to happen? What's this all about? Notice in verse 14 it says, and the holy place will be restored. Now, that to me dates this prophecy. It dates this prophecy, I believe, to the realm of Antiochus the Fourth. It dates this prophecy as terminating in about 168 B.C. You say, does that mean it's all back there for history? Remember different views of Revelation, different views of Daniel? It's all back there. It's all out there. Remember, I told you, I think it's for us as well as back there and as well as out there. Now, here's the deal. I think that Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth is a type of the Antichrist that's mentioned in chapter 7. But I don't want to identify them as being the same thing. There have been types of the Antichrist all through history. I think that Hitler was a type of the Antichrist that will come one day. I think the dictators and those ungodly nations through the years are kind of a figure or a foreshadowing of that great Antichrist that's going to come one day and be the total embodiment of Satan. Now, John says in the book of 1 John, the Antichrist have already come into the world, the spirit of the Antichrist. I think he's been here through history. Antiochus was one of many that have that attitude against God. Now, chapter 7 is the great Antichrist, I believe, of the book of Revelation. Chapter 8 is a historically identified type of the Antichrist in 165 B.C. in the kingdom of Syria, the Seleucid Empire, and Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And I do not want to identify them as on the same thing. One is a type of the other, but one is much more fuller and complete, and that's chapter 7. Now, so this prophecy to me is dated historically. It's finished, it's full, it's complete. And yet, as many times the prophet said, I'll give you an example. A little phrase, the last time, it's been the latter days. In Habakkuk 2:3, refers to the destruction of the Babylonian Empire, and that was fulfilled historically. So the latter days in Habakkuk 2:3 did not mean the end of the world. It meant the latter days of the destruction of Babylon. To me, this little phrase here pertains to the time of the end, does not refer to the second coming of Christ, does not refer to the end of the world. It refers to this prophecy, when this prophecy will be fulfilled. Now, chapter 7, I think, is way down the line. Chapter 8, I think, is historically in Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, so, but as again, the Bible mixes these two, remember? Every prophet saw the historical setting of his day, the tragedy that came, as foreshadowing the coming of the Lord one day. So too, Daniel's vision sees the judgment of Antiochus the Fourth as a foreshadowing of God's judgment to the Antichrist that will come one day. Now, notice in verse 19, if you please, the little phrase, the final period of indignation This is going to be the whole thing. I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, and it pertains to the appointed time of the end. Now, when is the appointed time of the end? That's the real question. Well, if you would please put down Habakkuk 2:3, you'll see it. You've got to look at the historical context of the passage before you know when it's referring to. I think chapter 7 refers to the end. I think chapter 8 refers to the time before. Matter of fact, this little word, the indignation, should a good English paraphrase would be the wrath of God, the time of the end, the wrath of God. These people are in bondage 70 years for their idolatry, aren't they? They're captive, their temple's destroyed, everything. And they're in bondage because of that. What God's saying is that period of judgment is not quite over. You're going to go back, but somebody else is going to get on your back for a while. So, the period of indignation, I think, refers to this period of judgment on the Jewish nation. Remember I referred you back in chapter 12, verse 12, the transgressions, is the same word that's used in verse 23 of when then their transgressors have run their course. And this does not refer to Antiochus or the Seleucid army. It refers to the people of God who are sinning. You see. So I think the deal is that God used this Seleucid king as his judgment. Just like he used Assyria and said, Assyria is the rod of my anger. Just like he used the man Cyrus and said, Cyrus is my anointed or my Messiah almost. God uses nations to judge his people sometimes. I think he used it here. Now, the ram in verse 20. The ram, why pick the ram as a symbol for the Medo-Persian Empire? Write this down so I didn't put it down for you. And put it by the little word ram and have it on your book, on your sheet. Number one, there's three possibilities. Number one, the zodiac sign of Aries, A-R-I-E-S, Aries is the ram. It is the zoological sign for the kingdom of Persia. Number two, in one of the Persian scriptures, which is Zoroastrian literature, I believe it's called the Bhagavad Gita, says that the guardian spirit of Persia is shaped like a ram. Number three, the Persian kings, when they went to war, wore a huge emblem of a ram. I think it fits wonderfully historically. Okay. Now, but verse 21, the shaggy goat. Why the shaggy goat? The zoological sign for the kingdom of Macedonia, which is, of course, Philip of Macedon, which was Alexander the Great's daddy, is the goat. The symbol is Capricorn. Zodiac sign. Number two, the national emblem on the Macedonian coat of arms is the goat. Now, I don't think that Daniel was doubling in astrology, but I do think he had to pick some kind of emblem to go with these countries, and these national emblems, like he picked the winged lion of Babylon, which is on all their temples to represent Nebuchadnezzar, was a beautiful symbol. And this guy didn't write in 165 B.C. Man, nobody lived that far away but remember back to those signs. This guy was current. Shows it's historical. Now, okay, verse 23, you see it says the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise. My Trinity has the word insolent, and I want you to see, if Deuteronomy 28:50, this word insolent means strong of face or bold countenance or set of his jaw, if you will. It means he was just downright mean. No mercy, nothing, just mean. And then it says skilled and intrigued. This word, a good English paraphrase might be double talk. And that's, you can just see in Maccabees how he tricked the people of Jerusalem with his agency. And then notice in verse 25 it says, the prince of princes. Now who does that prince of princes refer to? You'd say, well, it must refer to Jesus Christ, prince of princes. But I think if you look at verse 11, back in verse 11 it talks about the commander of the host. You see that? And you look, now mine has a 2 by the side of commander. You see that? Do you have any kind of, I hope you have a reference edition Bible. Over in my margin it says, or prince. So it can be prince of the host of heaven or commander of the host of heaven. Now there, God the Father is called a prince. And here I think it refers to God the Father. Nowhere else in the Bible is God ever called a prince except right here in this chapter, twice. The prince of the commander, the prince of the host of heaven, and the prince of princes. The prince of, well, however you make the plural of prince. And then finally it says, and he will be broken without human agency. There's two trains of thought here, two historical lines. One says Antiochus Epiphanes died of some kind of disease, a slow disease in Babylon. Others say that he died of a terrible stomach ache. It just kind of ate him up from the inside. And so some people see that as the judgment of God on this man. I really don't know. I want you to know this. In verse 27, when Daniel got through of all this, Daniel got sick to his stomach and went to bed for a few days. That's kind of the way I feel when I get through chapter 7 and 8 and 9. Man, I don't know what in the world all this stuff means. Just like you, I just have to wade through it and try my best and pray about it and hope that God will show me what he wants me to know. Now, does Daniel chapter 8 refer to the second coming of Christ? How many would say it does? Okay, how many would say it doesn't? Okay, why would you say it doesn't? It's very important for me to know, if you know. Verse 14 is the key, right? All this is going to take place when the holy place will be restored. Now, we know just all kinds of extra historical evidence that it's 168 B.C. when Judas Maccabeus restored that temple. So, I think this thing is referring specifically to this particular time.